Welcome to the Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. Before we begin today, we would like to express our thanks to Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona for their commitment to not end the filibuster in the next 2 years. Because if they had agreed to do that, we would have to find a new podcast name after the first episode. Our appreciation to them. Now, while the Senate filibuster provides unlimited debate, we'll be similar in that we will not limit our topics, but we will place a limit on the duration of our discussion. But regardless, we hope to reflect the world's greatest deliberative body and be a forum of civil debate and discussion of major issues from our academic, political, and Christian perspectives. Our first podcast focused on the domestic policy and political legacy of the Trump administration. Today, we tackle the foreign policy legacy of the Trump presidency. I'm Sean Evans. I'm chair of the Political Science Department at Union and host of the podcast. I'm joined today by Greg Ryan, who is the Associate Professor of International Relations at Union. Welcome to the podcast, Greg.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to start the same way we started the last one with. And so that's kind of the idea of what were the successes and the struggles in the Trump administration. So let's start off. What do you believe were, say, the three biggest successes of the Trump presidency in foreign policy?
At least the attempt, and I think the attempt in itself is important, to reorient the U.S. relationship with China, to see it for what it is. Secondly, that there were no new wars, which is something that might have been somewhat, you know, unremarkable in past periods of American history, but to go 4 years with no new wars, I consider to be a fairly important accomplishment. And also, I think trying to bring allies into, at least remind them of the possibility of paying a greater share of taking care of their responsibilities in collective goods products, defense products, among others.
Okay, great. Thanks for giving us those three successes. Let's start off with the first one, because I think that's the one where I think he will have long-standing impact, in that Trump decided we needed a more sober, critical approach to China, and I think that's something that now everyone on both sides of the aisle believe to be correct. So how did Trump reorient our China policy, and how successful was that?
Well, I don't understand all of the details, but certainly there was a major attempt to redress kind of the balance of trade situation with China. Really, for at least 40 years, you know, they have sold here and we have bought, under the assumption that, yes, it's helping their economy, it's raising the global living standard, I suppose, but the very act of neoliberal, you know, trade was going to bring China around in certain areas. That assumption was the post-Cold War assumption. But it really, even with Obama, who raised it with his pivot to Asia, essentially American corporations were doing the same things. And they were being treated the same way, i.e. the joint venture system that Deng Xiaoping set up allowed Chinese companies basically to get all the technology they wanted from American companies and then push them out.
Right. So the joint venture idea is that a international company comes in, they have to partner with the Chinese company if they're going to do business there. Yes. Okay.
Google and Baidu would be a kind of classic example. And, you know, once Baidu got what they wanted, Google was pushed out. But I think that Google still hopes to get back into China. And China tends to dangle things out there and stimulate hope. But I don't think there is a lot of hope. Now, that being the case, what Trump did was try to say, look, let's be realistic about China. And the idea that neoliberalism conquers all is not realistic. Therefore, let's try to protect not just trade. Let's try to protect the power grid. Let's attempt, and H.R. McMaster, the lieutenant general who was, for a time, Trump's national security advisor, has come out and said this in a recent piece in the Washington Post. They're kind of trying to update our understanding of the Indo-Pacific region. We have to change that major assumption that China is going to be essentially eased into our own world order. He said, no, they're resisting. And they're resisting that because of their own national interest, and we have to face up to that.
Right. So I think what you're saying then is with the neoliberal idea, it's the idea that markets would lead to prosperity and eventually would lead to a more democratic China. Is that what you're referring to?
Sure. The idea that rising incomes lead to broader expression, more education, and thus a societal situation where there are different viewpoints to be expressed. It's appreciated that different viewpoints should have an outlet, and thus it moves you towards democratic politics,
right?
That idea. And I think that's the assumption we had, right?
So how successful do you think the Trump administration was in achieving their goals vis-a-vis China?
Only somewhat. The major success was putting China on notice, putting the American people on notice. But unless that's continued, I don't know how successful it will be in the long term. Certainly, whatever Trump's comments about Xi Jinping in the beginning and his penchant for personal relationship diplomacy. At the end, the Chinese did not like Donald Trump. The headline of the Global Times or the People's Daily was in big black letters, "Good riddance."
Good riddance. Yeah. So, Donald Trump was a force of instability in terms of the relationship with China.
Well, yes. Yeah. And again, I tend to view the Trump presidency favorably, but will willingly concede that he may have been more of a breaker than a builder.
Right.
Right. I just think that that was something, an assumption that needed to be broken. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I look at the Trump presidency at times, I look at it as a yes, but presidency. Yes, he had a good idea, but he sometimes struggled to implement a plan and be consistent in his interactions with others. So, for example, in China vis-a-vis trade, he was tariff man, trying to put these tariffs on them. But our trade deficit worldwide and with China really hasn't changed, even if you look at before the pandemic. And as far as the plan of China buying all this extra goods from the U.S., they really haven't followed through on the promises that they made.
Well, and that, it gets to, look, I think that the general statements from the new administration will be very similar.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't think in many cases that the specific issues under what we'd call the mantle of the U.S.-China relationship are going to change that much.
Right. So,
if you look at for instance, I mean, Trump had an executive order keeping Chinese companies away from the power grid. That's mm-hmm. been reversed, right? That would just be one example of many which tend to indicate, whatever the broad statements of an administration, the specific measures that it takes or allows may not match up with the broad statement. So I think Trump did the country a tremendous service in trying to sound the alarm on this. Mm-hmm. But unless it's something that's continued across administrations, it may not have long-term impact.
Right. So before we head over to the next two successes, let's follow up a little on this idea, because one of the things we've talked about is how one of the other things that is significant about Trump is the return of great power rivalry, which probably was the decline of great power rivalry is probably a result of the post-Cold War period, the fall of the Soviet Union, and so that was natural.
The unipolar moment.
Yeah, right, right. So what are the prospects for China being a major competitor in world affairs, challenging U.S., maybe not primacy, but at least the role that they have played?
Well, I think that they will challenge for primacy. I think that there are a lot of problems, okay? The Belt and Road mm-hmm. Project, which is very, easy to kind of conceive of in broad terms and fits with the idea of the great game, the idea that if you control Central Asia, you control the world island, Europe and Asia, and therefore you control the world, right?
Right. And for those who aren't familiar, what's the Belt and Road Initiative?
The Belt and Road Initiative is a massive infrastructure projects, mainly rail lines, highways, ports, airports, utility connections, stretching really from you might say the East China Sea to the North Sea, and the Mediterranean. So a lot of on the ground physical connectivity and communications connectivity with China, and the spokes running all the way to Scandinavia, to Central Europe, to the Mediterranean, and also into Southeast Asia. So it's a massive, concept. And of course, China has a tremendous advantage because Chinese banks can offer terrific terms and they come in to do the financing. So there is some resistance to it, especially in European countries. However, politicians who are looking to provide things in the near term mm-hmm. for their populations, lines of communication, more cost-effective, it's tempting for them.
Right, and the idea is by offering these loans, it means the countries that are receiving these loans are going to be a little bit more supportive of what China wants to do. And sometimes with these loans, if the country is unable to pay them back, then China takes control of the infrastructure. And so there's a power play associated with this to make more nations dependent on China.
Well, and now, absolutely, in the outer areas, let's call them, maybe the most China hopes is silencing of certain criticisms. You talked about China taking control. I mean, there are specific examples. There was a shipyard that Chinese companies built and financed in Sri Lanka at Hambantota. And when they couldn't pay the loan, the Chinese moved in and essentially took it over. Also in Cambodia, the area of Sihanoukville, where China has always had tremendous influence, or across millennia at certain times have had a tributary relationship with whatever Khmer kingdom was there. They essentially have a colony there. Mm-hmm. And it may help the Cambodian economy, but it's also a big travel destination for Chinese who can't avoid going to Hainan Island. They can go to Sihanoukville and have their vacation on the sea, on the, a tropical sea there. But all of this, now, there are going to be problems with this. There's going to be pushback. There are going to be engineering problems. There are going to be financial problems. But it still is moving forward. And certainly, China is going to try to frame it as being the rise of the East, you know, what it's going to the manifestation of the rise of the East, in that you can't trust the Europeans, you can't trust the Americans, because the memories are there and right. resentment is there. Now, there's resentment against the Chinese from these countries too. Yes, too. Right. So, but those type of issues are important. The other thing I would say is the Chinese are they're very aware of the polarization of the United States, mm-hmm. and will do everything they can to exploit it. You know, in the technical area, they are not at our level yet, but they're making progress.
And that's why we're so concerned about the intellectual property theft, because they're trying to take shortcuts to catch up with us.
Sure, and some of that comes through just internet theft.
Right.
But the other thing that's there, I mean, I'm much less concerned about the Russia threat. And when I get into conversations, I tend to say, how many Russian nationals have worked in Silicon Valley and gone back to Russia? There probably are some. But of course, the follow-up question, obviously,
how many Chinese? Yes.
Right. So, you know, so many of the things that we would have had a lead on before, perhaps while we were trying to construct that lead, there were Chinese nationals with green cards who were participating in it. They go home, and our lead evaporates.
Yeah. So what would you say to the people who say, okay, the Pacific is the rising economic region. We kind of pull back after pulling out of the TPP. China created the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership to kind of take that place, and it's making more countries in Asia more reliant on China, while the idea is that with the TPP and other things, that was a signal that the U.S. would still remain engaged in the East.
Right. Well, the RCEP is in some ways not as invasive. For one thing, it doesn't have an investor dispute mechanism, which was probably one of the most objectionable parts for populations, because an investor dispute mechanism essentially says countries that are operating within the rules of the TPP, their own products, policies can trump national laws, right? So the RCEP is in some ways freer, but it's the organizational partner of the Belt and Road system.
Yeah. Okay, real quickly, any comments on China's belligerence in the South China Sea, their policies toward Taiwan, the crackdown on democracy protesters in Hong Kong, the Uyghurs?
China is getting away with all those things and will continue to do so. Right now we're in a time of testing. Last year, according to Reuters, was the most active year in the Taiwan Straits in decades. This is what the Chinese do. They've been flying across the center line, bleeding the Taiwan Air Force. They're looking for an opportunity, and something could change there. It depends, and maybe nothing will in the short term, but it's something that I'm really interested to see what develops.
Okay. Well, let's go to the other two successes you said. No more wars and allies burden sharing. Anything extra you want to say about the idea of no more wars?
No, I just think it's significant. I think that the conflicts we have been have not really been in the interest of the huge majority of the American people. And I think Trump got that, and I think Americans were happy about that.
Okay. In terms of allies' burden sharing, you're referring to NATO countries deciding to increase their defense budgets.
Correct. And again, we'll see if that lasts. it may just be a temporary thing. But trying to get greater participation and commitment of resources in these types of collective goods areas, and just attempting to mitigate the free rider problem. It's never going to be. The largest player is always going to pay the lion's share. But if you can get something at the margins, right, that's good.
Okay. So we've gone through your three successes. Now, I want to raise this because if you look at most people's assessment of his foreign policy, they mentioned two other things as his successes. One, he played a role in defeating ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
And two, people point to the Abraham Accords,
mm-hmm,
where the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco has normalized relations with Israel. And even Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has actually met with the Israeli Prime Minister. I mean, it was an unofficial meeting,
sure,
but he still met. So are those things you also consider successes, or just not on the same level as the three you've already mentioned?
I do think they're successes. I would say a couple of things. Which maybe gets to some of the problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of this is based on the alienation of Iran. And I am very much for the establishment of diplomatic relations. I do think it's a terrific thing that some of the smaller GCC countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, these Sunni oil monarchies, have established relations with Israel. The basis of it, though, of course, is to unify against Iran. I think that's a huge part of why it's happened. And Iran has its own problems, and I don't trust the Iranians. However, I think that Trump decided to really push the, you know, hard line against Iran, pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran deal, mm-hmm, because it had tremendous domestic popularity. Because people, I think, their view of Iran, if they're over 50 years old, it goes back to the hostage crisis.
Right.
Iran called us the great Satan, and we said, no, you're the great Satan. So why would you want to talk to them? However, I think we have solidified Iran's place. There was a time, there have been times when, because of the liberal elements in Iran, they've wanted to reach out. The hard line, mm-hmm, has not. And now I think the hard line is very much in control, which pushes them completely into the arms of the Russians and the Chinese. And there may have been a time when they could have come back towards us, particularly opportunities American companies who built original infrastructure in Iran would have gotten contracts to be able to go in and
now,
update it.
I think there were some people who would say that there were probably some problems with the JCPOA in the first place, in the sense to where Iran got all the benefits up front, and it did nothing about their support of terrorism in other places. But I think what your argument is, that may be the case. I could be mistaken, but the idea of preventing Iran from getting the nuclear weapon was more important.
Yeah, well, and again, this gets to, we can talk about this, whatever positive things, and there are plenty that I can think of, that Trump at least tried to move the country toward. He did not have a good understanding of how diplomacy proceeds. If you can just get one thing done and try to make that the basis for other things, lock in the one thing, support the one thing, as opposed to saying we've got to have it all.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, look, JCPOA was only really about nuclear material and processing. It wasn't about missiles, and it wasn't about Iran's support for Shiite or other extremist groups in the region. So much of the denunciation of it said, why weren't these things included? Well, you get what you can.
Right.
Try to lock it in, See if benefits flow from that in better relations, and then maybe you can consider the other thing.
So basically, what you're saying is you have to think in terms of the long term.
Right.
Okay. All right. So we've looked at some of his successes. Where do you think Trump had his biggest struggles in foreign policy?
Well, I think that he just kind of continuing from what we talked about before, his ability to understand that connections have to be made at many levels to proceed. North Korea is a classic case of that. You can just put Trump right in that category of political outsiders. Not that there's been somebody exactly like Trump before, but let's say presidents who've come in and have had not much foreign policy experience. You know, I think Lyndon Johnson, in some ways, he thought that if he could just get the man in the room and talk to him, then he could persuade him and everything would change. And I think Trump had that same kind of focus. And you have to build, you know, rapport at so many levels, relationships, and whatever, you know, moment of good feeling there may have been between him and Kim Jong-un, the systems are so opposed. The gaps in understanding are so large that those efforts, while I think we should be in favor of trying to find, reassessing relationships, I think that's good. In general, there wasn't the plan behind it that was needed to bring it in. And I think the odds would have, even if there was a plan behind it, I think that the odds would have been against it. Okay.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the things that our political leaders suffer from, not just in domestic, but especially in foreign, is, for lack of a better term, what I'll call the great man theory of leadership.
Sure.
That one person can go in, they're such a good deal maker that they can sit down with anyone and make a deal. The idea is it's about those interpersonal relationships. When it's not always about personal relationships, it's about national interest.
Sure.
And as you pointed out, our systems are too very different, and the ability to get North Korea to give up their nukes when that's their only bargaining leverage with anyone to get the oil, the food, and everything else they need is probably optimistic, to say the least.
Well, I think there was a hope that perhaps there might be some schism with China.
Mm-hmm.
And there may have been the possibility of that. However, just given, let's call it the Chinese orbit, and North Korea getting out of the Chinese orbit, all of the historical dynamics tend to favor that not happening. Right. So...
Okay, so you've mentioned the point about the idea he misunderstands personal relationships. Does that also connect to the idea that he didn't always recognize the value of allies and international organizations and treaties?
To a degree, but I think, again, he would, if he had had a second term, who knows? I think he was trying to figure out what to break, and he did a lot of that. He didn't let, you know, again, we were told, oh, he's going to pull us out of NATO. Well, he didn't pull out of NATO. He came around on NATO. General McMaster says, you know, he did a decent job of trying to organize the Indians, and he did have a fairly good personal relationship with Modi, the Prime Minister of India. The Indians, the Australians, the Japanese, behind the scenes, he did a fairly decent job of starting to try to tighten that coalition. With regard to his argument regarding the Paris Climate Accords was not an unreasonable argument. The idea that the treaty was actually aimed at the United States in ways that it was not aimed at India and China. But he was certainly someone who did what I, made important statements regarding what's international society about? Mm-hmm. Is it really to bring us the benefits? And I think you would certainly agree with this. International society, that is, we would call them the international elite across borders, they have succeeded in preventing major power war for the last 75 years. But at a time when, and there was no year like last year, it was a record year, the elites, their income level continues to separate from the average individual. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't more decisions be made in local areas, right? That was a push of what he was trying to do. So you would expect, reflecting that, he might be somewhat mistrustful of long-standing international agreements and agreements that were often made right at the beginning of the post-war era and that they need to be reassessed.
Right. So, right, okay, I can see that point of view. I mean, I guess the point that I would kind of push back on this is, okay, yes, I mean, you're right. For 75 years, the context was created for greater wealth, rising living standards, expansion of democracy, but yet at the same time, they were not as working as well today as they might have been in the past. And it seemed to me that he tried to, he was more inclined to pull out instead of reform.
Yeah.
In this regard.
No disagreement there.
So, for example, like the Paris Agreement, it was more symbolism because it was non-binding.
Right. Right. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You got things like you're pulling out of the WHO when the pandemic is a global pandemic, and it shows that even if the WHO made mistakes, we still need to do a better job of trying to handle global pandemics. Pulling out of the INF, Open Skies, New Start.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems...
I didn't necessarily think pulling out of the intermediate missile pact was a great idea. Obama had accused the Russians of the same thing, right? So...
Right. It's not that Russia was violating the agreements, but do you pull back or do you try to do something better? I mean, the way I look at it is he had some success changing NAFTA to the USMCA,
sure,
which was basically an updating of NAFTA, making some changes, which were probably largely good, even though it didn't really alter that much of the deal in the first place. I always thought he'd be better off if he tried to reform and said, here's how we need to make things different, mm-hmm. Which could have not only improved the operation of those institutions, but could have also increased his power vis-a-vis other nations because they wouldn't have held him at such a distance. Because while I understand you have some reasons to be critical of allies are also force multipliers in some ways. And if we could get everyone together to, say, negotiate with China on trade, that gives us much more power than if one nation itself does it.
Yeah, I am guessing because he faced so much bureaucratic resistance in the United States, he assumed that the bureaucratic machinery of former PACs would also be difficult, and thus it would be better to scrap and rebuild. But in some cases, the time wasn't there to rebuild.
Right, and he never really proposed a rebuild on me.
He had, he didn't always have. And again, I mean, it was tremendous bureaucratic resistance. And I think that because of that, his ability, I think that he misconceived about that, right? Mm-hmm. He assumed that when he won the 2016 election, that a lot of a lot of those who had been opposed to him would come around, and that never really happened.
Okay, so you said one of his big challenges was he overestimated the importance of personal relationships mm-hmm. with other leaders. What are some other things do you think he was not as successful at?
I don't know how successful he was in managing just hemispheric affairs. It seems to me that there were real possibilities in making better relationships in Latin America. If you're going to tame U.S. businesses and try to reorient them more to, let's say, jobs in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
some of the historic problems, which have been private corporations supported by American foreign policy, that Latin Americans see as having a very negative influence on their history, perhaps there could have been an opening there. And that could have dealt with other things, caravans and everything mm-hmm. else, right? Freedom for all of the states and national determination, okay? Self-determination for the American states. Tierra del Fuego to the North Pole, right? Something mm-hmm. like that. I think there would have been an opportunity there. I don't even...
So basically he was potentially so focused on the immigration idea that he was unable to see the bigger picture of what's going on in Latin America and working in a more productive manner.
And you know, you could generally say that building a wall was something that was very visual.
Mm-hmm.
It was a symbol. It was a way to mobilize a coalition. So something like self-determination for all the states in the Americas and building a wall, one of them is just a much easier political program to push because people, they're for it or against it, but they can visualize.
Right.
Right. So that was part of his dynamic and his ethos. Thus, he just tended to double down on those kind of things.
Okay, so we talked about personal relationships, hemispheric relationships. Is there another struggle that stands out among you?
Not that comes to mind immediately.
Okay, let's kind of talk about some of the other criticisms we've heard of Trump from some of the foreign policy establishment. So, for example, there's quite a few says that by his actions, by his personality and other things, that he harmed the U.S. global image, which indirectly affected the country's soft power. What would your response be to that?
I think it's interesting because that's undoubtedly true at some level. However, so much of that comes from this kind of concept, which is tossed around in the media, of global opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is global opinion? Is it just the opinion of international society and the international elite? I think that there were members of, let's call them historic majority populations in many countries who were supportive of Trump. So those that have the microphone or the electronic connections may say that, and it's true as far as it goes. But I do think that this is it's where we are in what I would still call the post-World War II era. The way that international collective organizations, the international economy or political economy, the power of multinational corporations, all of those things, there has been tremendous pushback against, and he was a part of that pushback. So their defense, those that would criticize, their defense of the current system, I completely understand it. They get the benefits. They claim to be giving us order, and at some level that's true. But there are plenty who would say you're taking a too big a share of the benefits. So I guess that would be my response.
Right. Well, I will point out, yes, while it's true that there are some nation groups that may be happy with Trump, there have been polls taken, at least in nations where we can be we can have some confidence in the reliability of polls, and opinions of him have not been very good, and the opinions of the U.S. have declined in some nations for that. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, well, I do think that decline is there, and I don't think Trump reversed decline. I think that's what he wanted to do, right? But
okay, let's pick up on one of the things that you've mentioned about the idea that the elites are benefiting and others are not. Is there something you think that can be done at the international level to deal with this? Or is this something that has to be determined at the national level?
I think it's more the national level. I would just say that connections among elites and different types of elites are important for that. When you look at a year like last year, the COVID year, and look at the top corporations in the world, the profits are up 30%.
Right,
it's the best year they've ever had, and people have suffered, and whatever these corporations support for broad values, more political rights, and a lot of very unobjectionable language, the reality in economic power is that the huge majority of the world's people are being left behind, right? So I may have lost your question.
No. That's fine.
It.
Well, let's kind of go to one of the other criticisms we see commonly lodged at Trump administration, that he lessened U.S. global influence because he coddled dictators of who he really never got anything from, and he alienated allies who were wary of working with him.
Yeah.
And because of that, that makes it more difficult to advance the interest of the nation.
I think it's true at some level. I think we have coddled a lot of dictators in the post-war era. A lot of dictators. And favored dictators. Because dictators at times protected U.S. corporate economic interests.
Well, and also in the Cold War, they were allies fighting
to a degree.
Communism, yes.
To a degree. Although you can look at various cases across South and Central America when the claim was, if we don't support a new leader, the Russians will have a base there. And I think that those were self-serving claims, which didn't really stand up to scrutiny. But in some cases, certainly. I think that supporting Syngman Rhee and General Park in South Korea, although they were not democratically elected, was probably in the interest of U.S. foreign policy? Yes. As far as allies, I mean, I think his relationship has been interesting. It's been, yes, controversial and up and down at times.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's true to a degree. Generally, what I would say, though, is, and this is a kind of a broad characterization of Trump, somebody who ran, an outsider, the probably the most notorious, why don't we use that word, political
right.
outsider in U.S. history, that ran against not his own party, which was he was a Johnny-come-lately to, but both parties, expect turbulence in a time when somebody is running against the post-war system at large. I still think the value is there of him pointing to certain things that people didn't see as clearly. The China challenge, the concept of the nation state, which neoliberal economics tends to crush into the dust. Those type of things, which elites can say, well, because you have pulled out of accords, because you've criticized allies, you have hurt U.S. interests. Well, U.S. interest according to who, right? If U.S. interest is simply our greater portion of the world economic product, but most Americans are not benefiting from that, that would be, I don't know if Trump, he probably wouldn't phrase it that way, but a spokesman of his word.
Well, he talked a lot about economic growth, and that's what he was looking for those years. All right, let's hit one other thing critics have had about him, and that is that his withdrawal from the world, even on a military stage, focusing on Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. The idea is he might have been trying to pull out of Iraq prematurely, which would allowed Iran to have a greater foothold there. With Afghanistan, he wants to pull out without an agreement in place, which would allow the Taliban to take over. And then when it comes to Syria, the idea he pulled out, that furthered the humanitarian crisis. People would say he betrayed the Kurds. He ended up empowering Assad, Russia, and Iran by that pullout.
Yeah, I don't have a look. This was raised about the Kurds, and it was brought up as some type. Oh, Americans don't do this. Which is laughable. We've done it again and again and again. Certainly we did it with all kind of people groups in Southeast Asia, okay? Some of them came to the U.S., as did some Iraqis, right? As have some plenty of Kurds. But the idea that we would support certain groups in perpetuity because they were our allies in the region for a time, that doesn't stand up to scrutiny over the long term. To point this out and say, oh, he sold out the Kurds. Well, what about the different tribal peoples across Vietnam who fought with us? Would we sell them out? So I don't put much to that. It's ugly. It's difficult. And it's one of those things that we need to think about when we intervene. That's one of the reasons I'm glad he didn't start new wars. With Iraq and Afghanistan, at the level we're involved in, I expect when we leave, there will be some potentially very negative things happen. And I think that's true if we left 5 years ago. I think it's true if we leave 5 years from now or 10 years from now. The assumption that, well, it was just going to be 1 or 2 years and then 10 years and 20 years of American influence is going to change the whole dynamic. Several millennia of history,
right?
I think is naive. When we leave, and I wish he had been able to pull out, especially after he lost the election, because it's the type of thing that there will be a mess. I think he tried, but it's going to be a mess whenever we leave. So why are we continuing to spend the resources there? And I understand it affects other regional actors in Syria. The Syrians have a high mistrust of the West. They have never taken a loan from the IMF or the World Bank. And the Russians obviously have their naval base at Tartus. I don't know how much good that we could really do there. I think we could kick up a lot more dust. But I don't really fault him. I don't think he, enacted any of those things perfectly, but I don't find major fault with what he did there.
Okay. We're kind of coming to a close here. One quick question here. There's been a Truman Doctrine, an Eisenhower Doctrine, a Carter Doctrine, a Reagan Doctrine, an Obama Doctrine, a Bush Doctrine. Is there a Trump Doctrine?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Again, I mean, whatever my level of support for Trump, I do not think that he was able, and part of this is just the domestic political situation, the disunity that's there. I don't think that he was able to tie things into a bundle and put his imprimatur on them, and that that is going to have the type of mandate over decisions and opinions and strategies going forward that those that you've mentioned have.
Okay, well, let's wrap up then. So how would you grade or assess the Trump foreign policy?
I'll give him a 6 out of 10.
A 6 out of 10. So that makes
maybe
it
a 7. I would say a 7. I'll give him a C. Let's move to a C. The C stands for China. Reorienting or attempting to reorient, and we'll see. We don't know what's going to come of that. Attempting to reorient on China was something that other presidents, Obama certainly, it was brought to his attention. He knew that it was something to consider, but he didn't do it. Certainly not in the way that reconsidering the terms of trade that Trump did. That alone, it was a tremendous, it took tremendous effort and will because the quick buck was against it. The quick buck of the most influential corporations in the world, probably. So, and again, I don't know that it will be able to be maintained. But I think that was tremendously important.
Yeah, I guess when I look at Trump, I think there is a little bit of what I mentioned earlier about the yes, but. He had some good ideas, but the problem was with the execution. I think that there was some continuity between the Obama and the Trump administrations in the sense to where both administrations realized that the United States could not play the role in the world that it was playing.
Yes.
And so they were starting to pull back from that. And I expect that to probably continue in the Biden administration as that goes. I think part of what I would probably criticize Trump the most about is, yes, there are some problems in the system that need to be changed, but he was the bull in the china shop. And when I think about a leader, it's not someone who just breaks things, but it's someone who tries to put things back together or put things on a better plane. And he seemed to lack the strategic sense and the skills to try to create a better system. Now, whether any president would be able to do that in our world today, I'm not sure. There's a lot of challenges that we face, but it just seemed he just never realized the impact of what he was doing and how to make something better than what we already had.
Yeah, I think that's true to a degree. I think that the amount of bureaucratic resistance toward him was greater than any president we've ever seen, and I think that plays a part in it. As a political outsider, I do think there are some things that he did not conceive of. Part of it was the amount of bureaucratic resistance, but part of it was, yes, certain ways that the political economic, as opposed to perhaps the art of the deal in a private transaction sense. I think there was a gap there.
Right. Yeah. I think part of the thing is if you're in a business deal, both sides realize they're getting something out of this, that both people can walk away with a win on some level. In international relations, it's not always a win-win situation. There's sometimes somebody wins and somebody is going to lose. And if people are not going to sacrifice on those interests, ergo, they're not going to be willing to make the deal that Trump may have thought was possible.
Well, and I would say, and I think anybody that knows me will know it's coming from me, is that Trump probably did not have cultural sensitivity and awareness and how he wasn't always aware of how cultural factors could impact negotiations internationally.
Right. I think the broader critique is that he lacked empathy on many different levels. All right. Well, thank you for this discussion on the assessment of Trump's foreign policy. This will conclude our second episode of the filibuster podcast. And with that, we thank you for listening, and I yield back the balance of my time.